Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is the Cyber Show. Fun, fun, fun. The opinions expressed in this show are those of the participants and are not the opinions or the policies of the show, the hosts, the station, or the owners. The rules of the road at the Cyber Show are: we don't talk religion or politics, we don't use the seven dirty words, and you can't believe anything you hear here.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. I'm going to be at the Chrysalis Conference in San Diego on Tuesday the 8th of November. That's Election Day, but don't worry, I've already voted by mail. Our monthly All.net members forum will be live online remote next Wednesday, an hour after the show. We'll be discussing how to counter influence operations with some of the best folks in the world. For details, sign up to the mailing list at all.net. That's ALL.NET. Coming up on Tuesday the 15th of November, our quarterly community summit for Angel to Exit will be live online remote starting at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. For details, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, dot C-O. For more details on this and other upcoming events, go to thecybershow.co.
That was amazing. I've never seen anything like that.
Now on to our first presenting company.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
Welcome. We have Romaine on the line from AdventWorks. And Romaine, just tell us quickly, what is AdventWorks?
Hi, so yeah, AdventWorks, thanks for having me first, Fred. So yeah, AdventWorks is a global studio based in seven countries right now. And yeah, we are creating high-quality video games for everyone.
So well, hang on, when you say high-quality video games, obviously we're going to want to play games, and I hate to do it, but can you tell us, you know, I guess there's going to be a link on the site to take us to where they can play a game, and it's free to play the games. Is that right?
Yes, definitely.
All right. Now, we're not going to give them the pointer to this until the end of the section because we don't want to, you know, wreck the show by having them leave there to play the game. Can you give us a sense? So what are the sort of the top three games you have out in the world now?
Yeah, so we've got a pretty exciting zombie shooting game called Last Dance Zombie Shooter. That you can find on App Store and on Android. We've got a game about horses called Real Horse 3D available as well. And we've got a very cool arcade game called Snake Blast to play.
Excellent. All right, that's just three of them. You create a lot of games, right? This isn't just your first game. You're creating one after another after another.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah, so just a sense of this. How long does it take you to create a game compared to a typical game studio creating one of these games?
Yeah, so we are really a game factory, you know, in a sense. So we've got really this ability of creating new games over and over again. And we are developed a tech that allows us to develop that quite faster, you know.
How fast? How long does it take you from the day you say we're going to do this game till you have a functional game that's ready to go?
Yeah, so right now we are really creating high-quality games. So the first version will be in 3 months. We do a first playable version in 3 months. And then it could be, you know, after less than 6 months, we can have a very cool, you know, first version. And then we iterate you know, on the game.
Yeah, so forever. So one of the things everybody wants to know about game companies, you have free games, so as a business, that doesn't work very well. So how do you make money?
Yeah, there are a lot of ways, you know, to make money. So basically the goal, you know, is to monetize quite well, you know, the time that people are spending in your games. So this is why, you know, creating very engaging and high quality games is really important, you know, because the more people, the more time people spend in your game, you know, the more time you've got to monetize them, you know, the right way. So we are monetizing with three aspects. So we've got the ads, right? So when you've got the time for doing that right, you can, you know, show ads at the right moments, doing ads that will bring value to the players, right?
And all right, we're going to talk about the details of this later, but three ways. Yep. Advertising, what's the second one?
In-app purchases.
In-app purchases, so they can purchase, yep, what, a new identity or a car?
Skin, exactly, bonuses, and yeah.
And what's the third way?
And the third way is more Web3 element. It's more like having value of what you're creating in the game, right? And going into a community shop where you can exchange things you've created and buy stuff that the other players have done.
So in the game, you're actually creating things, and you can actually, as a player, monetize that by effectively selling that to other players. Is that right?
Exactly. This is a very exciting new way of, monetizing.
That's fascinating. I love that. All right. So look, we can't keep having this conversation now because we have to go on to the next thing. But will you come back for our next show?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time.
So, Chris, what do you think?
Right. This is fascinating. Thinking his third point of, right at the end there, he's talking about monetizing, players monetizing inside a marketplace inside the game. And the very first massive multiplayer game, Solaria, Earth 2025. I was playing it. It was just one ongoing game. Then it got popular, and there was a number of games they would run for months at a time in parallel. And they kept adding features. And the market, I figured out how to win it. It'd be like 10 or 12,000 people in the game. And I could always end up in the top 10, caught up and win it. And it was all economic. And they ended up developing a marketplace. You see this in some games today. And, just like in the real world, if you have the economics, you can buy the military, you can, do the things to make it work. And that's the 90s, mid 90s, 96, 97 kind of thing. And fast forward to to now, on the way you pass WoW Gold, right? Remember this? How long has this been? 10, 15 years ago? The world was sort of shocked when you could sell someone a sword, for example, that takes 12 hours of gameplay for 20 real dollars, because players started to say, 12 hours of my time is worth 20 bucks and I want the bloody sword.
I don't think that's the only thing they're talking about monetizing here. And the one that he mentioned and the one that I've heard other companies that just make their entire living by is creating skins for people.
Well, what really has me thinking about is the metaverse, right? And the Neil Stephenson fans will know this from Snow Crash. And, we've all been thinking about this, virtual reality or realities that we create. And we may be on the bubble of that. Maybe it's starting to happen. I have three 20-something kids, Terry, Roxanne, and Damien, and they've grown up with this. And they're immersed and they understand it in ways that I can't, but I still don't get the feeling that it's quite there yet. But the structure, you hear what he's talking about, a factory, making games. Gaming is no more, we know this, huge companies out there making games, but it's also getting richer and more complex. And, my little sidetrack on the market there. So in virtual reality monetization, in real money, a real object. This has to be pondering, if you hold an actual sword, from a physics perspective, you can break it down to say it's nothing but information, energy levels, defining matter and so on and so forth.
But now you're getting into the issue of cyber currencies, right? This is the thing where, we talk about the tulips, right? The big tulip craze where things become worth enormous amounts of money and then that market collapses. And the difference is in the days of, the tulip bubble, at least you had a tulip. if the game stops, if the company goes out of business, all that stuff is worth nothing.
Well, but the real, it doesn't have to be cryptocurrencies. It could be real, US dollars, being exchanged in the market.
But eventually the companies go out of business, right?
You can establish a business in a fisherman's wharf in some city and, over the decades, it's suddenly not there anymore. Those things happen anyways. I think it's interesting.
But everybody that has monetized the game, that has bought something from somebody else, has no value left in the thing they monetized.
It's
the same with subway tokens or airline tickets or anything, right? Is that your
point? Things move on anyways.
Yeah.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Coming up on Tuesday, the 15th of November, our quarterly community summit for Angel Exit will be live online remote starting at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For details, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, .co. To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. Well, now, on to our next company.
You wake up in the morning and it's 12:45. You want to have a little fun. You brush your teeth. You brush your teeth.
We have Nathan of Enamel Pure on the call today. And Nathan, let's just start out. So what does Enamel Pure do?
So Enamel Pure is a startup company building a tabletop laser solution to revolutionize preventative dentistry.
Okay, so that was very quick and very salesy, but we're gonna break it down. So first of all, you're shooting lasers at people's teeth. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So what keeps the laser from, you know, slicing off their gums or, you know, blinding them?
Oh, the system's completely foolproof. You can't hurt any other tissue. It's a very low power, couples directly into enamel. So it's molecular coupling of the laser wavelength. So the effect of cleaning teeth or purifying teeth is accomplished without any harm or any danger to any other tissue.
So when you say it's low power, how low power are we talking about?
Oh, it's less than a watt. So you have 60 and 100 watt light bulbs in your room. So it's extremely low power.
You know, so laser pointers. We know if you shine laser pointers in somebody's eye, they sort of get blinded. Is it as bright as that or not?
No, because it's a longer wavelength. So the laser pointer is a shorter wavelength that will go in your eye to your retina. Because we're using a CO2 laser, it's a wavelength 20 to 40 times longer than your laser pointers, and it can't penetrate the eye.
Okay, so safe. That's, you know, usually when we talk about medical stuff, we talk about safe and effective. That's safe. Tell me about the effective part. What makes it effective compared to, well, let's say, what are the alternatives? Let's start there.
We start with every aspect of preventative dentistry, which is the cleaning of the teeth, the killing of the bacteria, hardening of the teeth, which is typically historically done with fluoride, and then the, you know, straightening or alignment of the teeth as well, which some people don't think of as preventative, but it is. That's why you get your teeth straightened or your jawbone or your jaw bite corrected. So,
right, well, so hang on. So you're not straightening their teeth with lasers, right?
No, the system it's a vision system with a laser. So we use the vision system to take pictures, 3D pictures of the teeth while the laser's cleaning or hardening the teeth. So both activities happen at the exact same time to save time for the dentist and for the patient. So it's two functions. One is the laser for cleaning and hardening, and then one is the vision system, the camera system, which does the image recording of the teeth in 3D.
So the alternative is what?
The alternative for the cleaning and the hardening is they go in with a pick and the drill, and they mechanically scrape it off.
All
right?
Stop. This is the thing where the dental assistant comes in and scrapes my teeth, right?
That's correct. So
I have one scheduled coming up very soon. Could I do this instead right now?
No, not right now, because we don't have FDA clearance. So,
all right, wait, we're going to talk more. I'd love, can you make it to the next show and we can talk on the next show?
Sure. That'd be great, Fred. I'd love to.
All right, so we're going to finish this down, but we're going to go on to the next show, and we'll talk to you then. Nathan, again, from Enamel Pure, and you can see his information on a2e.co, or you go to the cybershow.co, and you can look it up.
All right, so interesting, right? You know, so trying to intuit what the technology is, you know, we're getting to, you know, at the end, they're talking about taking the pictures, right? So I could see this, trying to picture physically what this thing is, but we should be at the stage, you know, personalized medicine. You know, your teeth are a perfect example. Every little, you know, everyone's different. And as we all know, the little tiny things make a big difference. So being able to map at that level, not just blast your whole body with hard x-rays and look at another two-dimensional thing, but map it with lasers in three dimensions, and cleaning and hardening. And you know, again, you know, maybe it's a generational thing. You know, I'm, you know, we're from the fluoride generation. You know, we've had better teeth than generations before us. God bless technology, but it's still a very shotgun sort of thing.
Well, I think we're going to talk about that in future shows with them. And I have some understanding of what's going on here, but my goodness, the idea of not scraping my teeth. You know, so, and to me, it didn't bother me that much, but I really don't, you know, that they make mistakes, you know, they get into your gums and it hurts.
It's sort of a bones thing. You know, you can picture a couple hundred years from now, the idea that you're going to take this stainless steel twisty thing and scrape your teeth, your part of your body, as opposed to, I don't know, killing the bacteria and the wavelength hardening enamel. I don't know the physics of that, but take it as a writ that they've done the research. You know, that would be nicer than just spamming your body with a chemical.
I will agree with that. So we'll hear more about that next week, but that sounds pretty intriguing, you know, and the other thing is dental care is really making revolutionary changes. You know, this thing where they make you a cap immediately, you go into the dentist's office and they, you know, they took a whole bunch of pictures and then they did whatever the dentist does to fix it up.
And then they go to their 3D printer and, you know, print a piece of ceramic
and then fit it on your tooth and you're done. you know, within 2 hours, you're back instead of waiting a couple of weeks with some temporary cap on your tooth. So I think there's a revolution in dental technology. And the question of how far it goes is important. And maybe more important, can we get it to the point where I don't need all that other stuff, where the restorative is something that almost doesn't exist anymore? That would be fantastic, right?
The home version, the toothbrush version of this, you know, when the technology gets to the point that we're all using it on a daily basis, and, you know, there's already a personal database of what your dental state is day to day.
Or maybe it gets to where you don't even need that. I mean, maybe it just gets to the point where you don't have to worry about brushing your teeth because, you know, you do this every month. Maybe it's inexpensive enough. You spend 15 minutes at the dentist every month instead of all that other time and all that other stuff you're doing. Maybe there's, instead of like dentistry, it's more like, you know, when they fix your hair. So when you go to get your hair cut, you also get your teeth cleaned.
You know, it's funny because, you know, the first time you and I sat down together at great length, it was a 6-hour conversation about electric toothbrushes. And this is the kind of thing that, this is a foreseeable Jetson sort of thing. So you're right. Maybe instead of, you know, in the same way as scraping stainless steel tools in the dentist's office, maybe scraping blunt pieces of plastic in a brush, as opposed to taking a little toothbrush-shaped thing that you put in your mouth and sterilize your teeth and harden the enamel every day.
Yeah, pretty interesting. All right, well, let's see what's next.
Now, on to our first service provider. Money.
Ralph, you're on the show, and Ralph, you find funding faster for folks. Is that basically right?
That's accurate, Fred.
I want to give some folks the background. I've known you for several years because you were doing factoring, which is a form of funding that's fast. And so you found factoring for folks. And after factoring, you've now moved on to a broader spectrum of funding things. But as I talked to you about this, I learned that you started your life in other things in the cyber world, and then eventually moved into what you've now called selling money. So I want you to tell me about selling money, because as a concept, if I say, well, you know, here's $5, can you give me $100,000? That sounds like a good deal. Yeah, sure. But there's got to be more to it. So tell us about that.
Well, there is. And as we discussed, one of the fun things about money is, you know, unlike when you buy products from other people or services, there's really not a lot of haggling. Once the money is scheduled to be set, it gets wired. It's very quick and electronic, and no one ever complains that it came in the wrong color. No one ever gives it back. Pretty much people that need money need money. And if we're putting them in the right place with the right type of funding to help them succeed, that's really the most important thing.
Well, when you say nobody gives the money back, that's they better give it back, right? Or else.
Well, they don't give the original money back. When the loan money lands, typically, I know there's a 3-day right of rescission, but I, in my several decades of doing this, have never seen anyone exercise a 3-day right of rescission.
So nobody has ever said, oh, you know, I changed my mind, here's the money back.
Mm-hmm. No. That never happens, never.
Right. So now let's talk about the different kinds of money. And selling money is an interesting thing, right? Because everybody sells something. Nothing happens until you sell something. But selling money is something most people don't sort of understand. So when you're selling money, there must be rules, right?
Right. And really what I'm selling is a solution. Money is just the part what people are looking for to get them from point A to point B. What I'm trying to do is assess their situation, what their needs are, what they're actually applying the money to, and then trying to find the best format, the best rate, the best price for them.
So when you talk about this, format, rate, price. So there's all sorts of complexity around money. And one of the things that I think people that are loaning money or investing money or all the different forms, the ways you can get money, is they seem to be a little bit tricky about differentiating themselves. It's really hard to figure out the implications for you when you're borrowing the money, even with all the regulations that say you have to explain it to. Can you talk to me about what's the reality here?
The reality is when you're looking for money, you might be looking for a type of money you heard about. So by coming to someone who's kind of worked with every format of money, from factoring to bank lines and loans and all the variety of different products that are out there, they can maybe clue you into some things maybe you didn't hear about that might be better for you than what you're looking for. Just having a professional that understands the way money flows, what you're actually needing, and can then explain it to you in a way where you understand it. Because you really do want to understand the terms of how you're borrowing, what you're borrowing, future caveats from who you're borrowing. In other words, today I can lend you all the money you want, but if one of your clients becomes more than 25% of your business, now I can't lend you as much. So there's a variety of different things and different lending formats that having someone that kind of understands and can explain it and bring you the best possible options, and then you can choose what's best for you is I think one of the best ways to search for money rather than specifically looking for a certain thing that you think fits for you now.
All right. So one of the core things you've just said here is that there are lots of options for getting money. And most people looking for money, in my experience, don't recognize that there are multiple options. That they're sort of at the point where they've tried what they thought were all the options and they've run out. Do you encounter that pretty often?
Oh, yes. Typically, when you're right now, especially, I say the banks are in, not to disparage banks in any way, but they're in a lending mode. And I say lending with quotes around it, because what's happening now is they have a very tight box for what they look for as far as lending. You have to be in business a certain amount of years. You have to have profitability at least 2 years in a row. Variety of different things that they need. Right now, their box is tightening even further. So we're seeing a lot of companies who 2 or 3 years ago, prior to COVID, could have gotten money all they wanted. Now, are having a hard time borrowing based on maybe some things that happened during COVID that now they're coming out of. They have the ability to re-ramp up and grow. But when a bank is a rear-looking product, so looking backwards, they take into account your last 2 years. Sometimes when you're growing, the best thing is looking for a funding source that's a forward-looking funding source. So funds based on your forward revenue rather than your revenue in the past years.
All right. We need to talk about this clearly a lot more, but we are running out of time for today. Is it okay? Will you come back next time?
Sure will.
Absolutely. Great. Well, now on to our next company. We have Mark from Firebots on. How you doing, Mark?
Very good. Thank you, Fred.
Nobody here knows what Firebots are, but obviously they're robots of some sort. And what do? They start fires or what?
Quite the opposite. This is a friendly robot. What it is, it's a fire suppression system for residential stovetops. You can mount it above your stovetop, right below a microwave or range hood.
Stop the advertising. Just answer the questions. No problem. So it puts out fires, right?
Yes. Automatically activates, will put out any kind of stovetop fire you have.
All right, when you say stovetop fires, there are a lot of fires that happen and they're not all on stovetops. So what's the advantage of having a stovetop fire suppression system?
Well, we wanted to concentrate. Half of all residential fires start on the stovetop. You're cooking with heat. It's a dangerous place. And that's a National Fire Prevention Association statistic.
So when you say put these things out, there are other ways to put out fires, right? There's this tuna can-like thing that puts out fires, and then there's sprinkler systems. Are there any other technology besides those two?
Other than, you know, throw a blanket over it, or if you have a K-class fire extinguisher in your kitchen, there's no other better way to do than our product.
Let's talk about the other one. So the tuna can. Tell me about the tuna can. What is the tuna can?
It's been around since 1972, over 50 years, and it's about 60% effective. It doesn't work all the time. It's a little bit like Wile E. Coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, where it lights a fuse on fire. The fire gets high enough to light a fuse. It burns down, and it explodes, and it dumps baking soda on the stovetop.
All right, so you're telling me what happens with that fire suppression system is it actually catches fire. And when it catches fire, it explodes, and that's how it puts out your fire.
Exactly.
So it's like send a thief to catch a thief, send a fire to catch a fire. All right, so that's one. The next one, and baking soda. Baking soda is not too bad to have poured all over your stuff, right?
It works, but it's got to hit the target, and that's the problem with it. I mean, if you look at most of your stoves, range hoods or microwaves, they only extend out 3/4 of the distance. Well, what about the last quarter? So if you're cooking on your front burners, there's not going to really be an effective way to extinguish that fire.
All right. Well, there you go. So now then there's the sprinkler system, right? The sprinkler system, that's expensive, but you install it and it's already in your house, right? Because you have to have sprinklers, at least where I live.
Yeah, and it's not in every house, and it is code for many, many apartments and condominiums, but not all of them. But even if you have it, yes, it does work. But think of this. You now have a stovetop fire, so now you have fire damage, probably smoke damage, and then sprinklers go off, and now you have water damage.
So you're just adding damage to damage. Sorry. So Firebot, of course, is completely different. And what does Firebot do that these guys don't do?
Well, we actually detect the heat from the fire. We're temperature activated. We'll activate, put out suppressant, not water, which will actually extinguish the fire and put a surfactant on top so it will not reflash in 5 minutes.
It actually cools the fire down. For 5 minutes, it keeps the fire out.
Right.
And so if you have a stove that's a gas stove and it has flames, then it'll put out those flames, but you'll still have the gas, right?
We've seen it do that. Yeah. And we do have a device that we can shunt the gas flow to that stove when you have a gas stove. So,
all right. So it puts out the fire. And what it puts it out with is this not toxic chemicals, or what is it?
It's biodegradable and non-toxic. Doesn't taste too good, but it will not hurt you or harm you in any way. You know,
you wouldn't want to eat the food, but all you do is wipe off the stovetop and you're back to cooking and starting your next fire, right?
Right.
We're going to continue the conversation next show, but we can't keep going now because, you know, we only have so much time. You'll be back for the next show, right?
Absolutely.
So, Chris, what do you think of Firebots?
So interesting, right? You know, so we're going after a liability issue. You know, I think there would have to be an insurance play. You know, if you can increase the effectiveness of this, I hadn't even heard the tuna can thing sounds familiar. I haven't seen one, which I guess is saying that those really aren't installed and deployed in the first place. So something like this really could be commoditized, and then you can work with code and insurance type of industries. It might be interesting. Yeah,
for sure. If the fires cost more than the putting them out. Then putting them out makes financial sense.
Individually, yeah. You know, hard to say, but at the insurance company, if you could cut your costs, you know, by, you know, installing these or requiring these, or, you know, having lower premiums for people with these, that can be the kind of thing I could see to catch on.
Well, there's individuals, but there's also multifamily housing and apartment buildings, and what do you got, like residents in, you know, where they have kitchens inside the units. So you're renting the place for a week. Presumably, you know, if you have a fire in one of those things, they must have them, right? They're all over the country. So if you have a fire at a residence inn or something like that, that's going to be expensive because everybody else has to get out of the building and, you know, it's a pain. And water damage is the other thing, right?
Well, and again, you look at the reducing risk over time today as opposed to 100 years ago, you know, houses burn down all the time for all sorts of reasons, candles and cooking fires and whatnot.
Yeah, and they burn down their neighbors' houses.
Right.
Right. So you start these mass fires and now you have to have fire suppression in homes in California. I don't know what it is in Florida or wherever. And do boats require, by the way, fire suppression?
You have to have a fire extinguisher on board.
Yeah, but that's not the same. Yeah. So in a house, you need like a sprinkler system. But imagine now on the boats, there's a little small extinguisher automatically sitting above the only place that really generates fire and puts it out.
Well, that's right. You know, in fact, you know, we discussed this with the Algatera, with the prototypes, we haven't done this, and onboard, you know, fire systems, same sort of thing. So,
idea of waiting for a fire, this is the problem, right? Fundamental fire alarm systems don't put out fires. They alarm, and then you got to go do something. But if you put out the fire before it does any harm, the alarm still sounds, but it says, alarm, alarm, we just put out a fire. You know, okay, good. So I don't have to rush out of the bathroom, you know, to outside or get out of my shower or whatever. It takes care of it. So I think fundamentally a change in the cyber world is going from detection to detection and response automated.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you know, what I would like to know more about is the bot part of the Firebot, you know, the detection part of it. Having heat is one thing, but having a fire is another. And I would expect that this is the sort of thing, again, we see this with AI and video recognition and all sorts of things today.
Well, yeah, that'd be an interesting question to ask him. But 250 degrees, you know, that's going to light stuff on fire, right? So 250 degrees is a temperature. For sure, there's a fire or something you want to put out, right? So I think temperature might be okay for this application, and especially because you're right over the stove. But we'll find out about this probably next week, right?
And now a word from our sponsor.
Coming up on Tuesday, the 15th of November, our quarterly community summit for Angel Exit will be live online remote starting at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For details, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, dot C-O. Well, now, on to our next company.
I'm working for an hourly wage. I went to high school, didn't do great. Still, I gotta make more cash. More education is what I'm looking at. When I get a degree, I will make a bigger salary.
We have Lakshmi Shingajanan from iZen. iZen.ai is their website. And they have a really interesting and unique capability that they've started to bring to bear in learning and education. So I wanted to start out just by introducing you guys and tell us, if you would, just basically about what iZen is. What does the company do?
Primarily, iZen is a workforce development company and education technology company. So we develop and deliver world-class e-learning programs that are outcome-driven, aligned with specific job roles in emerging technology areas like cybersecurity and AIML. And we work with thought leaders and do the instruction design so that people are really engaged and they learn by doing, leveraging our ecosystem of tools like Cyber Labs, so that when they complete the course, they are ready for the job. They are ready to hit the ground running. So that is the first aspect of it.
So training for people to be able to get jobs.
Yeah.
And but it's also education, right? It's so I think of training as something where I learn how to turn a wrench or whatever, and education as I learn why to turn that wrench and when.
That's right. I mean, while we work with educational institutions, but still the current focus is on how do you develop employable talent. In some sense, that aligns more with the skill rather than the broader education, though what we provide caters to the educational needs as well. Because remember, we provide both the conceptual programs, meaning starting from foundational to practitioner level skills. So that way, people who don't have the right background can start with the education or the conceptual delivery of our programs, and then quickly move on to the practitioner level ones that can align with the jobs that they want to get into.
Yeah. All right. This is still generic. Give me an example of three courses that you actually offer, and tell me just quick, what are the examples?
Yeah, we have introduction to cybersecurity, introduction to artificial intelligence. We have courses that prepare people as machine learning engineers and data analysts.
So I take the intro to AI course, and in how many hours am I then able to have an AI system that replaces my conversations with my student?
Probably that's going to take a long time. However, a lot of these applications that are currently being done using AIML, those kind of applications are taught in this program.
Give me an example. What's one of those applications?
Simple things like sentiment analytics. How do you analyze tons and tons of social media feeds that are coming in after an event? For example, you launch a product, and what's the Twitter saying? What's another social media feed saying? So what's the general sentiment of people in response to an event, for example?
So that's an example where a company would have one of their workers who isn't an AI specialist, but it's a product developer, who says, yeah, well, when we push the product out, I want to be able to do a better job of evaluating it. So they could take that course, or somebody that works for them could take that course. How long would it take to learn that?
So we have programs that go from usually from 3 months to 6 months, depending on how much time they can spend every week, of course.
Yeah. All right. But so what if I'm, I have like a week off of work. I'm going to spend 1 week of intensive learning. Can I learn that kind of thing in a week?
Depending on your background, of course, yes. Because, if you talk of machine learning, for example, it requires a lot of foundational things. You need to know what is AI. You need to know some Python programming. You need to know some bit of data science and statistics and other things that...
If I want to learn the data science and statistics, then I have to go to somewhere else to get that course. You don't have a data science or a statistics course.
We have a course that will prepare you enough to get started with machine learning.
There you go. All right. So look, we don't have enough time to keep going into this, but can you come back for the next show and we'll talk about this a little bit more?
Thank you, Fred.
Chris, what do you think?
So online education, there have to be new and better ways. My three kids in their 20s and watching them go through the education system in that era and where we are right now and where we need to get. The pandemic has pushed the traditional educational model really, really hard. So we're all out here trying to figure out, what the virtual work, remote education thing is like. Yeah, and looking at the generation we're coming into, I think the time, the form and format, is folks like iZen working really hard on it. But the generations coming up are not going to be marching the halls, to get all the skills.
So one of the interesting things that I came to conclude some years ago, and, if I've been doing graduate education as a professor and so forth for quite a while.
Right.
And one of the problems is, you can only teach so many people. Today, the claims are we need, 750,000 people right now in cybersecurity in the United States or something, or is the demand, and there's no supply. Well, you're just not going to get that 25 students at a time from even if you had 1,000 professors in cybersecurity, which we don't, but that would only be 25,000, every few years. You know, you could get up to 25,000 a year with 1,000 professors teaching 25 students. That's not going to get to 750,000 for 30 years.
And those are the students that can actually get there. You know, as a teenager, you know, I got a full time job at the Sears catalog printing factory in Toronto. And didn't finish high school. And for 6 years, you know, working swing shifts and so forth, I had no educational opportunities. Couldn't take day classes, couldn't take night classes because, you know, next week I'm on a different shift. So, you know, the traditional model has been a problem already. And we have these abilities we have now, right? You know, why on earth, if I'm 17 or 27 or 57, do I have to find the time in my day to schedule into, you know, get into a class? That's not the way I get information anywhere else.
Right. So what you're saying is just the whole idea that we have a whole bunch of people meeting at the same time in the same place for that particular function is problematic.
And post-pandemic, we're all thinking, you know, through, you know, conference and events, you know, travel. What does it even mean anymore? You know, I've enjoyed my decades of world travel. I plan on doing more of it. But, you know, I'm reminded of Francisco bought WebEx, I think back, you know, decades ago now, that a television ad, you know, with a senior person was showing all these things from all over the world in his office, and a junior person saying, yeah, it's great, going to be great to have you in the office. Of course, now we're not even going to the office, and we need the in-person thing. As we were talking about with the gaming company earlier, you know, this metaverse thing is not here yet. You know, just not the same. You know, virtual is not the same. However, yeah,
but I don't think we're going back.
We're not going back, no.
Yeah, so if you're not going back, you got to go forward. So this might be a path forward.
It is definitely part of the path forward.
There you go. All right, let's go and listen to the next one. Well, now on to our next company. Alex from Proper Parts, great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm well, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing just great. So tell everybody, what does Proper Parts do and what makes the parts proper?
Well, it started with me being a mechanic for many years and installing a lot of garbage parts that broke the first time you put them on the car. It also has to do with, in England, all cars are motor cars, and a Rolls-Royce or a Bentley is a proper motor car. So as I stumbled into making auto parts, aftermarket parts for Rolls-Royce and Bentley, we came up with proper parts for proper motor cars. Then we expanded to Range Rover and GM. So it's little of the meaning is lost in the translation, but we're running with it.
So GM parts, that's not a proper motor car, most GMs, right?
Well, no, but Rolls-Royces are put together with GM parts. Or at least the old ones were.
There you go. So your parts are proper, even if the cars are not.
Correct.
So you say you're getting crappy aftermarket parts and you wanted to make good quality aftermarket parts. So, you know, this is the Cyber Show. And by the way, if people want to find you and get parts for their cars, they can go to thecybershow.co and look you up. You're listed there under Proper Parts. And I guess your website is like Proper Parts. Right.
.com.
Yeah, you can't hardly miss it. So tell me something about, you know, how you came to be making these parts, what kind of processes you have. Obviously, this is not something you do by hand with lathes anymore, right?
The business has gotten very diverse. It began, a friend of mine bought a 1981 Rolls-Royce, and the power seat didn't work, and he asked me to take a look at it. And, of course, the cushion comes off the seat like your couch, not like a car, but, you know. So we picked up the cushion and looked under it, and there was a little motor there with a piece of tape around it, and everything else was missing. We peeled the tape off, and it said Delco. And we thought, huh.
So it's not exactly a Rolls-Royce part.
So I went to a junkyard and I looked for a motor like that under an old Cadillac seat. And I took all the stuff from that seat and we came back and had to modify it a bit because some of the stuff was a little different, but we made it work on the Rolls-Royce. And it was a $6 part out of the junkyard instead of $1,250 from the dealer. And they had already quit selling them. So it was unavailable.
So I hope you didn't charge them $6.
Well, on that one, those were free. Those were on the house. I then put one on eBay and I advertised it as a Rolls-Royce part, which of course it was. And the auction closed at $485. And I thought, that's life changing. And
so you can just become like a junk dealer and make, you know, $400 on every GM car you found.
We sure did that for a few months, but it turned out most of the stuff in the junkyard was in such bad shape. The housing was falling apart on this power seat component.
That's the term junkyard.
Yes. And we invested about $35,000 in a mold and started making a new housing for it.
So now you got somebody to make a mold for you and you have an injection mold company making the injection molds.
Yes.
But that was before you started to get into the cyber side of the business because you found some other problems, right?
Oh, we found power seat computers that would shove you into the steering wheel while you're driving. That's just...
It's a bonus feature.
I have a customer with a Range Rover who would come out to his garage in the morning and his power seat was all the way back and laying down in the back seat. And he asked his wife, you know, why are you doing this to my car? And she's like, you're crazy. I'm not touching your car. But day after day, he comes out and he finds his seat all the way back and folded down. And he said it was becoming a problem in the marriage until one day the car started shoving him into the steering wheel while he was driving. And he thought, oh, well, maybe there's another problem.
It might not be my wife. All right. So let's talk about what you did next, because you know this is where your business evolved into something that's much more interesting. And obviously, because we are the cyber show, we're going to want to talk about those cyber issues. And by the way, automation in cars doing bad things to the drivers, not only is it a safety hazard when you operate it, but this is part of what they're talking about from cyber threats. And just so we have a time frame on this, what's the date when this started to occur, as far as you're aware? What's the earliest date?
The earliest date when these units started to go bad?
Well, when they started to push people into the steering wheel and go crazy.
Information is very hard to come by. You know, Rolls-Royce will not admit there was ever a problem, to my knowledge. I believe Avant Electronics, the mastermind behind this component, is no longer with us because of this component.
Okay, so we don't actually know when it was happening.
I don't know.
It was before 2000, right?
I would guess right around 2000. You know, the few years before it, these batteries seem to last 10 years and then they leak their acid out and cause all kinds of havoc on the circuit board.
Oh, well, that's fun, of course, as well. So look, let's talk about that in the next show. You will be here for the next show, right?
Sure.
All right, great. So we'll talk about those particular problems next. So Chris, what do you think about car seats 20 years ago pushing people into the steering wheel and causing marital problems?
Well, right. You know, it's everything from I interviewed with Disney a couple of years ago. It was one of these headhunter things on LinkedIn. And just scrolling by, you know, ignore most of it, but it's like, this one works for Disney. So I talked to Disney. I had this fascinating set of interviews and got a real insight into where they're going. And as a huge Disney fan, you know, I got the chance to say, ooh, I'm thinking, you know, your next generation, two generations from now, you're going to do these things. And got confirmation, right? And looking backwards, as we all know in cybersecurity, you know, we're, what is it now, Fred, a decade or so past the cable news, you know, people hacking Jeeps. It was Chris Camp. Yeah. His last name right now. But anyways, you know, so we're sort of deep into this in this phase, right?
Well, yeah, but this is different, right? This was before there was any remote. There was no computer in the car that anybody thought about at that point in time. They were just starting to put devices in the engine. I guess they had some devices for automatic tuning and those things, but they didn't have the car bus in 2000, as far as I remember. Maybe it was in there by then. But this was completely different. You know, these are cars made in the 1990s or 80s.
Yeah, more electromechanical, right? From the sounds of it, you know, some chemical issues with battery leakage or whatnot. But, you know, it's automation at the end of the day.
Right? And the chemical spills, it's getting into the control system, right? So this is an automated control system for the seats.
Right. You know, as you know, I'm talking to you right now from a self-powered solar electric boat that was built in Key West, and I've sailed 1,000 miles so far. But, you know, I keep coming back to the point that before you can have an industrial control system, you have to have an industrial system that you need to control, right? And so this, I think, is an interesting example as we started to, you know, electric seats, you know, were not new in, you know, 2000. You can trace these things all the way back into the 50s. But as we got to closer to 2000 and getting more complicated, you know, to the point that, yes, it may be, you know, electrochemical, mechanical. And of course, now we have, you know, such complex automation and just barely scratching the surface, you know, where we're taking this much, much further over the next 20 years.
I'm unclear that we can even do car seats right yet. So, right. You know, I mean, I have electric windows on cars that have gone bad too, right?
Right.
And so there's the question of planned obsolescence, of course, but I don't think that's the issue here. I think this is that in the design, the architecture of this system, probably the battery was located physically on top of everything else. So it burned through the system and caused the seats to go bad instead of the battery being under. It's one of those unanticipated consequences of an engineering design, probably, right?
Well, and you couple this with our ever reducing risk tolerance. Right. And you see this is, you know, as you know, you and I have worked a lot in manufacturing, critical infrastructure and so forth. And you get inside the manufacturing plant at, you know, for example, Rolls, an example here, they're amazing. The safety built in to areas like that, you know, underneath the seat and so forth, the testing and rigor, you know, and the experience, you know, decades more of experience are making the system safer and safer and safer.
I bet the car seats can still accidentally lay back or shove you into the steering
wheel. Oh, and like I was going to say, yeah, our failure states are getting more interesting, right?
You know, yeah, there are more and more of them, but even 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they were... You know,
it can only crush you into the steering wheel. You know, these days,
well, maybe lay you backwards when you're driving. I used to have a Range Rover, and when that seat goes to lay you back, you can't get anywhere near the steering wheel. I mean, you're like practically in a bed. And I'm anxious to, you know, hear what, you know, what comes next week. I think that's going to just get more interest.
Well, I've got to touch on just about the small business changes of mass manufacturing, 3D printing and so forth, you know, the opportunities, you know, to retrofitting as the example. But again, the world is changing whether we like it or not. And
oh, I think we're going to get into that too.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our monthly All.net members forum. We'll be live online remote next Wednesday, an hour after the show. We'll be discussing how to counter influence operations with some of the best folks in the world. For details, sign up to the mailing list at all.net. That's all.net.
It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Now, on to our next service provider. We have with us Perry Peterson. Perry is a retiree from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he worked on some of the most interesting cyber stuff at NRC for quite some time. Perry, say hello.
Hello.
This is radio, Perry. You got to be, you know, more active. You got to talk more. I know you're a quiet sort who never says anything. So I want to start with one of the coolest experiments that was ever made public after being classified that you funded. And you know just what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, I do. I believe you're referring to Aurora.
It was called Aurora. So tell us about Aurora briefly. What did Aurora do if people don't know about it?
Well, it demonstrated the basics of power engineering 101. In other words, if you disconnect the load from a generator and then quickly reconnect that load to the generator, it's going to be out of phase. And that out of phase condition can generate a huge amount of torque. And if you do that repeatedly, you're likely to get some damage, which is exactly what the test demonstrated up at Idaho National Lab.
Okay, so when you talk about some damage, you speak in such genteel terms. You shook the crap out of a generator until it just about blew itself up. Is that really what you're trying to say?
Yes, there was a lot of smoke and there were pieces and parts flying around. It didn't totally disintegrate, but yes, it was no longer functional.
No longer functional, as if somebody in the room might have gotten killed if you hadn't put it in a room where nobody was standing.
We built a brick wall around it just in case.
And how many vents were there in that brick wall?
Yeah.
What was the brick wall damaged?
I don't recall that the brick wall was damaged. No, it was fairly well contained. It wasn't like the major chunks of metal went flying. It was all the stuff attached to the generator, but evidently inside the generator, there were pistons and parts that were chewed up and crunched up.
Fascinating. Okay, so this was when was this? This was in 2007. And I just want to talk a little bit about timing. So, you know, when I was at Sandia in the late 1990s, we were working on critical infrastructure protection, and I was doing the power grid, among other things. And one of the things we noticed was that this could happen, that you could induce this by cybernetic methods, and that might have a disruptive effect on various components of the power infrastructure. Structure, potentially with long-term effects. We published this and it was classified at the time. It has since, you know, long been declassified, I think partly because of your experiment, which demonstrated it clearly to the whole world. But in terms of timing after that, as I recall, there was this thing in Iran having to do with nuclear something where something similar happened. Now, without going into anything you wouldn't be allowed to talk about, do you? And I assume you don't know anything actually specific about that. Can you tell us whether that was reflective of a similar understanding of how things work and break?
The only thing I know about what happened in Iran is what I've read in the media and also reading several papers on it. And one of my primary sources was Ralph Langner, and he did some of the initial analysis on what actually happened. But I think that the similarities are best described as the lack of detailed, rigorous engineering, right? People put together systems and they make them functional and they worry about it performing performing its design function, but they forget about the and nothing else. And it's the and nothing else that provides space and opportunity to make systems do things that they weren't designed to do. So I think that's kind of the level of similarity.
Okay, so you know, we don't have time to go on forever with this, so I'm going to take a break here, but will you come back for our next show and talk a little bit more?
Sure.
Chris, I know you know Perry from before. What do you think of the beginning of this discussion?
You know, first, for the record, I love Perry. I love our tribe. Right. It, you know, folks out there have to understand, you know, who Fred is. You know, you know about virus because computer virus was first written down in his PhD thesis. And I've been at this stuff for a while, too. And in this case, we're talking about operational technology, OT. IT moves data, OT moves things. And in 1990, I worked at General Electric and I ran the OT network, you know, to maintain this plant floor network. And I got to look at both the cybernetics of the time to the cases that Perry's talking about there. I got to see a machine tool installed. There was a three-dimensional lathe that would move a single piece of metal in three dimensions, the size of a Volkswagen bus, and there was 3 feet of sand around it, this three-story hole they dug in the middle of the plant, because if it jammed, it would shatter it. So you get the engineering rigor that Perry is talking about in the physical work, but then this thing is computer controlled by an OT network that I, because I wanted mobile video conferencing, connected to the IT network and therefore the internet, that any fool in those days could have logged into that computer and broken that machine, you know, that multi-million dollar machine and the whole supply chain, you know, making power turbines of that plant. We've slowly gotten there, and Perry's experience, what he's talking about with Aurora and what happened the TANs in 2006 to 2010 or whatnot, went public 2010, I think. There are shades of things to come.
So it's interesting that you talk about that sort of robotics stuff. When I was first in robotics was in the early 1970s when I was at Carnegie Mellon, and they were doing lots of studies into robotics, and they had a robotics institute that they founded there at that time. But the first thing they were doing was working out the equations for being able to control the pose, you know, position and orientation of a manipulator. And so, you know, we were just figuring out those equations and getting it so that it could be stable, and if you put load on it, it doesn't have positive feedback. So those positive feedbacks in those days were creating, ultimately, these things would tear themselves apart, and those problems were solved. And then another problem was being in the proximity to these devices. So, you know, when you're trying to manufacture stuff, these robots are moving around quickly. They're quite heavy, and if they accidentally, you know, touch you in the head, you're dead. So these kinds of things were still being solved in those early days, just at the lowest level. And I'm not clear that they're solved today. We're now sort of undoing the things that we figured out. Like, you know, we have these robots roaming around the world. We have, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles that are being used in military situations. And, you know, people can take over control of those things. And of course, we're presumably taking over control of some of these, the Ukraine is presumably taking control over some of these things when they're owned by Russia, and Russia's probably trying to take them over from the Ukraine. And so when you start to get the cybernetic stuff in physical contact with people, the forces involved, the timeframes involved, and the potential damage becomes much more personal. I'm not talking about Terminator type world in the future, but I think there's all sorts of crap going on here. But of course, you know, Perry is in the nuclear space. So in the nuclear space, I think it's absolutely critical you have robotics, because people just can't get near that stuff. So, you know, what is this mix? What are these trade-offs? I think that's a fascinating subject to be getting into. And I love to see it evolve. And it's amazing that over our lifetimes, things have changed as much as they have.
Right. And you know, looking at it with my Augutera hat on, you know, I'm getting to the stage now where I'm building these robotic systems, and we'll see how far that goes. But you know, we've thought this through, and you can see where it's going. And I think in redundancy, you know, it's not just marine systems. Things break, and this is where we're getting into these things. Let's leave nuclear. Right.
Marine and in space and in nuclear, you know, these are potentially serious negative consequences. So when you're on a boat, we've talked about this a lot. When you're in a boat, if one thing goes wrong, you have redundant systems. If two things go wrong, it's tough, but you can make it. When three things go wrong, you're probably dead.
Right. Yeah. The third thing kills you in the water. Right. Yeah. But the way you deal with it.
And in outer space. But how about in outer space?
Right. Well, yeah, but I know in a marine environment, you know, you can practically deal with this. Did a lot of work with Unisys in Colombia, and you and I put together that 25-year plan for the National Critical Infrastructure Operator, and you could see it unfolding. You know, like we're pretty well into that for 7 years, and the next 8 years, that, you know, 7, 15, 25-year evolution. And with Carlos Castaneda and I wrote that chapter in the current Canadian Colombian Navy manual on cybernetics.
We're going to be talking about this for months and months. So,
right, yes, you know, individual systems can be compromised, devices can be compromised, but we can build a redundant system. And having more of this, I think, is the way out.
Resiliency is critical here, and safety is critical here. And these are things that most people in the space today, because they were brought up not in that environment, don't necessarily get.
Yeah, sailors don't trust any one thing, anyways.
All right,
I'm going to be at the Chrysalis conference in San Diego on Tuesday, the 8th of November. That's election day, but don't worry, I've already voted by mail.
Now, on to our next service provider. Charles Preston, great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
So, you know, Charles, nobody really knows about what you used to do, but you were an early cyber cop, right?
No, I didn't actually mix cyber, computers, the digital realm with law enforcement.
Until when?
Well, ever.
Oh, is that right? So you were a cop in Alaska.
Right.
But my impression was that you did a lot of work running their cyber systems, right?
I was involved in some. Yeah.
So talk. Let's go. Quit being so conservative. Speak up.
No, I only used the technology that was available to help law enforcement, for example, creating databases for law enforcement intelligence.
So when you say databases for law enforcement intelligence, what is that?
Well, a lot of law enforcement depends on seeing and doing or being told about something and some reaction or taking a reaction to it. But the more you know about the people doing things, the less likely they are to be able to do them with impunity or to be able to harm other people. So you'd like to have advanced information about what they're doing, who's likely to do it, events that could occur. For example, a major motorcycle gang is planning on visiting Alaska, and some of the major motorcycle gangs got involved in various kinds of criminal activities.
So when you say intelligence, you're talking about information. Is this, you know, confidential informant type information, or is this public domain information, or what kind of information are we talking about?
Well, it would typically be a mix of information from confidential informants, sightings turned in by law enforcement personnel about people of interest, locations of interest, and trying to put all that together.
So when you talk about this, presumably this system, if there are confidential informants involved, it has to be pretty well secured. Is that right?
The idea is it should be pretty well secured, yeah.
Okay, so there seems to be a slight difference between should be and is. So can you tell us, again, this is a long time ago. None of these systems are hopefully in use today. Give us a sense of the kinds of things that went right and went wrong and what was done well and what was done poorly in law enforcement, including, I guess, connecting to the FBI data sets and so forth.
Well, the FBI correctly had regulations or at least guidance about any system that was going to connect to NCIS.
Which is?
To their database.
So when you talk about they have not quite requirements, this is like what Perry is talking about when he talks about regulatory agencies, right? They sort of suggest what you're supposed to do, and that becomes the minimum standard, right? And the minimum standard becomes the maximum of what they do. Is that basically how it works?
Yeah, that's been my experience.
Yeah, not just in policing, right? That's your experience. You've done years of work as a consultant for corporates and all sorts of other folks as well, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that guidance is treated as the maximum that they'll do. And if they can avoid it, they will, right?
That's often correct. And they often have target budgets, and the people responsible for the security of their systems have guidelines that they're not supposed to exceed for their fiscal year or their planning periods.
So all these people are always balancing one thing against another, right?
That's right. The responsible ones would like to improve as much as they can, as soon as they can, but they can't do it all at once.
So have you ever been a responsible person that wanted to improve things and couldn't quite do it all at once?
Only for my own. That's not completely true. I tried to offer some guidance when I still worked for the state of Alaska Department of Public Safety. I tried to provide some guidance to people in charge about the state of insecurity of the information they were storing on their computer systems. And I didn't find that they were very receptive to the idea.
God, this is such corporate speak. Okay, so ultimately, what I think you're saying is that lots of people sincerely try to do the best they can, but they're in environments where you just can't do that much. You're limited, so you do what you can do, and that's just how it is, right?
That and general perception, which was probably not as well informed at that time, and I'm talking decades ago, general perception that other people could get into your computer system, get your information, do mischief with it, or be embarrassing. There hadn't been as many huge examples of break-ins, like tens of millions of people's personal information disclosed by...
Well, let's be clear. There were no publicly disclosed instances of that. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. Right?
Right.
Yeah. Having been a consultant in that time frame, I will inform you now that you're mistaken about the number and quantity of bad things that happened then, but you're correct about the fact that people didn't know about it.
Well, the perception of management that those things could happen and that they were reality rather than an attempt to spend money.
All right, let's talk about that next time, because I think that that's critically important. But in the meanwhile, are you willing to come back next time?
Sure.
Okay, what do you think of the cautious manner in which facts get slowly revealed?
Right. Well, the whole thing has me thinking about policy hacking. As I move these boats across the 500, 600 miles of Florida coastline, the maritime aspect of the vessels is one thing. The cybernetics is another thing. But really what matters is policy. You know, we're right in the thick of it right now with supply chain security. You know, how do we share this information, protect it, intellectual property and so forth? Same issue. How does law enforcement with these boats? You know, I've talked to law enforcement, at every level, Coast Guard, Florida, the state FWC, county, local, and when I have conversations with them, I say, just imagine this world where you will have the ability to have appropriate access to data that comes off all these boats out here with cameras built in and so forth. Because if someone's dying, it'd be really, really handy to have a quick video right there. There's a boat nearby with a camera right there. But how do we do that? The Charles point, the point that's embedded in his caution and the conversation you're having there, well, having appropriate controls over it, because obviously, we don't want the black helicopter folks looking out of the cameras built into our cars and boats and everything else.
Well, we'll be talking about surveillance a little bit, later on in the month with Charles, and that'll be full of surprises as well.
It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed the show today. Next week, we're going to have another show where we continue many of these conversations and introduce some new folks into the conversation. That's going to include discussions with Carrie and Hank and a variety of other folks, and of course, continuing the sagas and stories of these companies and people as we go through their lives and careers. You can hear the full recording of the interviews on thecybershow.co. We'll see you next week on The Cyber Show.